It may be hard to believe, but Thanksgiving is just a couple of weeks away, just a little over 2 weeks away. And that means, of course, there will be plenty of dishes and desserts at the table at most of them. And I bet your pets will do just about anything to get a taste of that delicious holiday food as well. Today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk has some rules to go over when it comes to feeding your pets table food. And she'll also talk about caring for your pets in colder temperatures. She's a professor, of course, of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And she comes by every month to give us advice on keeping our pets happy and healthy. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It's nice to be here.
And here we are, Thanksgiving coming. And I know you've thought a lot about this whole business of food for your pet and
people food. Yeah, because we all do it, right? I mean, sure. It's one of those things where who can like look in those eyes looking at you, you know. But I have some rules that need to be followed, and so I call this Sawchuk's Rules of Feeding Table Food. The first rule is your pet can't be overweight. Well, mm-hmm. That knocks out about 50% of the pet population, unfortunately,
right there.
Because they, you know, we have a huge problem with obesity in our pet population. They still have to eat their own food, too. So we don't want a dog to become finicky and go, hey, I'll just hold off for that piece of turkey when their complete and balanced diet is sitting there. And so we need to make sure that they will still continue to eat their own food. They can't beg. Well, there goes a whole bunch more, okay, because you don't want this dog to be a nuisance. Like, can you imagine having people over for Thanksgiving dinner and here's, you know, this dog drooling on their shoes? Well, welcome to my home. But and so we want to, you know, try to have a pet that's well-behaved, that can be sitting off at a distance and know that they may get something, but they don't have to put on a show to be able to have you give it to them. It needs to be good food. And what do I mean by that? I don't want them to be getting the turkey skin or the gravy off the plate that can be greasy. It should be lean, cooked meat or vegetables. Nothing greasy or fatty, because the last thing you want over the Thanksgiving holiday is to have a pet with an upset intestinal tract. Okay,
No.
Okay. And so that's the other rule, is it can't upset their intestinal tract. And most people know that if I feed my pet something, they get an upset tummy, don't do it again. But, you know, if they do have a very sensitive gut, then obviously avoid table food. And you may have to have your guests learn these rules as well. And it has to make up less than 10% of their diet. When we start getting over 10% of their diet consisting of random things from the table, that's going to throw the balance off and in the long run can be unhealthy for your pet. So there's my six rules of what to do when you've got a pet that's asking for Thanksgiving dinner.
And we have those rules up on our Facebook page. So if you didn't get them all, go to our Facebook page and you will find them there. You'll also find, I see Tracy sent a photo of her little dog.
Oh, my goodness. The teddy bear is bigger than the dog is.
Yeah. There's little tan. I don't know what breed that dog is. It is so cute.
It looks like a poodle, Bichon, something mix, something like that. But, oh, my
sitting
goodness.
Sitting on a chair with this huge panda bear.
Yeah.
Very cute. Thank you for sending that, Tracy. If you have a photo to send, why, please do. We had an email question, by the way, for that photo. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. Email question from Todd. We have a 3.5-year-old male cat who's very healthy and active. Occasionally, I'll give him a little egg yolk left over from our eggs over easy breakfast. This isn't every day or even every week, but I'm wondering if there's any negative impact. Also, are there foods we should avoid giving him? He gets very little people food.
Oh, this is perfect question for our topic today. You know, the only problem with eggs would be that if you feed consistently raw eggs to your pet, and it sounds like this is cooked eggs because it's coming from your table and you're not eating raw eggs, you run the risk of salmonella infections and so on. But there's a ingredient or a chemical in eggs called avidin, which binds B vitamins. And you can actually cause the cat who has, they have a very high need for B vitamins, a B vitamin deficiency, and that can end up resulting in some neurologic signs. So frequent, like daily raw egg ingestion could be result in some pretty serious health risks. But a little bit now and then, if, as long as, you, again, your cat meets those rules, I would have absolutely no trouble with you doing that. But things to avoid, you know, cats are pretty good at discriminating what they should and shouldn't eat. But there's even, you know, just in the news this week, one of the major pet food manufacturers, Blue Buffalo, has launched a recall on some cat treats because they contain an ingredient called propylene glycol. And propylene glycol is used in a number of things in food manufacturing because it helps hold moisture. So those soft, chewy cookies may have that we eat may have propylene glycol in it. It's recognized as a safe ingredient for humans and dogs. It's also used in pet-safe antifreeze. But for cats, they are overly sensitive to that particular ingredient. And unfortunately, Blue Buffalo, their treats had this in it. And it's been banned from cat food since 1996 by the FDA. And so somehow this has gotten back on the market again. And just anybody that's got those treats out there probably should be kicking them back. So they're being recalled. So you can pick up something else instead. So avoid things that have propylene glycol in them for cats especially. Obviously, chocolate's one of those things. Most cats are not going to eat chocolate, but dogs, oh my goodness, they really like to get into that. And, you know, the toxicity of the chocolate is really based on what strength of chocolate it is. You know, milk chocolate, about an ounce per pound of body weight is considered the toxic dose. But if you get into baking chocolate and some of the really high cocoa content chocolates, obviously that's going to be very different. There are available for no charge apps for your cell phone that's called the Chalk Talks app, okay, and you can plug in how much your dog weighs, how much you think they ate, and it'll have a little dog there that's either wagging its tail and happy, where it's probably nothing to worry about if your dog got a chocolate chip or something like that, versus, you know, they're on the floor saying, get me into the emergency clinic. So check that app out. Raisins and grapes, not a problem for cats, but definitely a problem for dogs, and can result in them developing kidney failure. And dogs love raisins and grapes, and it takes very few, just a small handful of raisins can put a dog into kidney failure. And it doesn't happen right away. It can be a couple of days down the road. So these dogs should go right into the emergency clinic, and so they can be given an emetic and then on IV fluids and have their kidneys monitored. Xylitol is a big problem for dogs, not a problem for cats. And that's an ingredient that's used as a sweetener in lots and lots of things. In fact, you can even buy it in bulk for baking, for making low glycemic treats and things for people that have an issue with blood sugar. And, you know, dogs that get that, that causes their liver or their pancreas to secrete insulin, their blood sugar drops, and it can happen within an hour, like very short period of time, minutes to hours, and they can die from it. So that, again, is an emergency. So don't leave your pack of gum around. Be really careful with things like dry mouth treatments and things like that that are, they have xylitol in them. People will leave those mints laying around and dogs get into them.
Frankly, someone who was on my show, a guest on the show, had that exact thing happen. The dog ate her gum.
Yeah, yeah. And that's all it takes. And so, you know, and it's, you have to be a label reader. And I really think there should be warnings on packages that have that on there for dogs. Onion and garlic is a big issue for both dogs and cats, but probably more so for cats. It can cause anemia. It causes something called Heinz body anemia. So we want to avoid that if we can. So no, you know, like fried onions or, you know, real garlic mashed potatoes or anything like that for your pets. So try to avoid that. Macadamia nuts can cause neurologic signs for dogs. And plus, who would want to share their macadamia nuts with their dog?
I know.
But and an upset tummy because they tend to be high in fat. Moldy foods and there's a whole host of things. And we'll get into more of this as the show goes on.
And we have, very good. So lots of good information there. Sue in Appleton has a question for you, Sandy. So let's go to Sue. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. My cat, Billy, is 15, and she became very constipated. She was straining to poop, and then she stopped eating and drinking. So I took her to the vet, and they gave her two enemas, and then they had to sedate her and actually physically remove Yes. She's fine now. Okay. They sent me home with a vial of polyethylene glycol.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on the internet and saw that that basically is Miralax.
Yep.
So
yep.
My question is, can I just give her Miralax?
That is the top thing on my list for cats that have issues. It's tasteless, and it helps hydrate the fecal material, so it makes it easier to pass. The reason why we see this as an issue in primarily senior cats is that anything that can throw their water balance off, things like kidney disease or diabetes, where they're going to be making more urine and kind of be walking that tightrope of being like almost dehydrated, the cat is going to start pulling moisture from their fecal material, which is going to make it drier and harder to pass. Add to that the fact that they're older and they may have a sluggish gastrointestinal tract. Now you're really asking for trouble. So I hope that your veterinarian also did some blood work to find out if
her
you're...
Her blood work was fine.
Perfect.
She was amazed that, you know, she looked like she was a five-year-old.
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad, because sometimes it just happens in older cats.
Yeah. But what should I be feeding her? She recommended just wet food, but Billy really seems to miss a little bit of kibble.
Yeah, there's kind of a couple of schools of thought, and it really depends on the cat and how they do, and so it's a matter of kind of trial and error. Some veterinarians recommend a low-fiber diet so that there's less ammo to be passed into the litter box, and so these would be things like the enteric diets or the intestinal tract diets that would be prescription diets through your veterinarian. ID, EN, low residue, there's a whole bunch of them out there. And that would be one path to take. The other is to go with a higher fiber diet, because fiber will also, especially if you're using things like Miralax, will help hold that moisture and keep the stools, maybe make them a little bit bulkier and a little bit easier to pass. So every cat's a different as to which way you need to go. I usually go the low residue route to start with, unless the cat has to be on a specific therapeutic diet for some health problem like kidney disease, where our hands are really tied, and then that's where we like to, you know, primarily feed canned food if we can. And I agree with your veterinarian, the canned food's going to give your cat more moisture, but a little bit of dry now and then's not going to be a problem.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Sue.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. And lots more photos up on our Facebook page, which is really cool. I love to see them. Matt sent us a shot of Peaches on the computer, and Peaches Marie is fat. How do I get her not to be fat? Matt wants to know.
Well, you know, weight loss, it's kind of a no-brainer. Less calories and more exercise. And for cats in particular, where those fewer calories come from can be very important. We'd like to usually feed them, I joke and call it the Catkins diet, which is a high protein, low fat, low carbohydrate diet. And these are usually things that you would be getting from your veterinarian as a reduced calorie diet to get started. The problem with feeding just regular cat food at the right level for the cat so that they're getting their caloric needs is we may not be meeting their nutritional needs. We're feeding for calories, and so you're not giving them enough food to be able to meet all their protein, vitamins, and so on, all those needs that they need. So that's where a lower calorie therapeutic diet from your veterinarian really comes in handy. And probably the biggest cause of obesity in our cats is lack of exercise. They're indoors, they're not having to hunt for a living, and so anything you can do to get your cat up and moving, whether it's even feeding them their food up on elevated surfaces so they have to hunt for their dinner, that may be helpful. And of course, meal feeding, actually measuring the food out so the cat doesn't self-regulate, because, you know, when you've got a 24/7 buffet open, you know, no one goes on a cruise ship and comes back weighing less. Same thing for cats. That food down all the time is going to result in them gaining weight.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Rebecca Haas, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. Thanks for joining us. If you have a question, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. We're getting lots of nice photos on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Post your kitty photo there. Here's one of Barb says, Buddy the Cat, this is from last year's Thanksgiving, Buddy the Cat saying prayers before Thanksgiving.
It looks like he's got his own place at the table. Look at that. Yep, he's sitting there just waiting for something.
Anthony sent a nice shot of his little beagle.
Uh-huh, that's a beagle, yeah, and a beautiful German Shepherd.
From Susan. Oh, thank you so much. So lots of nice photos. Keep them coming. We love to see them. Brenda and Hilbert has a question, so let's go there. Brenda, thank you for calling.
Thank you for my call. I just have a question. My black lab has just been diagnosed with Lyme, and she said it doesn't necessarily mean she has Lyme disease, but she tested positive for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but it has attacked her kidneys, and within a week's time here, she... her kidney creatinine went from 2.8 to yesterday we had her in, and it's now 6.7.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I am so sorry. Yeah. You know, unfortunately for dogs, I should say fortunately, about 95% of dogs that are exposed to the Lyme organism never show clinical signs. But there is a very serious form when the Lyme organism attacks the kidneys, and it's called Lyme nephritis. And it can result in kidney failure. Your dog needs intensive, round-the-clock management right now, probably on intravenous fluids, blood pressure monitoring, and it's a critical care type thing. And sometimes we can turn these dogs around and be able to get them back to maybe not 100% kidney function, but better. So this is one of the reasons why, you know, we promote using flea and tick control on dogs year-round up here, because the deer tick that carries the Lyme organism loves this cooler fall weather. They like that 30 to 40 degree weather. And even in January and February, we may have a little bit of a bloom that where it's a little bit warmer, and then we'll have these ticks come out again. So year-round flea and tick control is really necessary for our state. And again, I'm very sorry about your dog. That's like the worst thing that can happen. And whenever I get a positive back on our little snap test, that's one of the first things I do is check kidney function. We usually do a test called urine protein creatinine ratio see if they're passing protein, and then follow up from there. I hope your dog's getting the care it needs. That's really sad.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling, and good luck. Appreciate your call. That's tough. John in Chippewa Falls has a question, so let's go there. John, hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I have a question regarding my 4-year-old yellow lab. He had TPLO surgery earlier this year, and he had a plate removed in August from that surgery. But my question is about a week after his surgery, he started losing his hair, and he's lost about 60% of his hair, and all of his fine hair is gone. You can see all the way through his coat, and you can see his chest where he's lost most of his hair. We put him on thyroxine, I think it is, back in early September, and his he's reduced some on how he's lost some hair, but he's still losing a little bit, and we haven't seen any new hair production. So wonder if you have any ideas.
Yeah, a couple things. I assume that before your dog was put on a thyroid supplement that they did some thyroid evaluation and found out that your dog is hypothyroid.
Well, they said he was borderline.
Okay.
And they didn't know if that would help, and so we actually stopped it now because the vet said last week, well, that doesn't seem to be helping any.
Yeah, and they can lose weight if they're not hypothyroid and you're giving them a supplement that raises their thyroid level, and then they can become more agitated. It can affect their heart. It's not a drug that we usually just hand out and say, let's give this a try. We usually have to have some good indication for using a thyroid supplement for these patients. One of the things that I get concerned about is there's a condition that we see, and I've seen this more in cats than I have in dogs, but it is, the name is something like telogen effluvium. And so it's a weird thing, but anytime that they're stressed, an animal is stressed, they can have like rapid hair loss, and they'll actually kind of go bald for a while, and then the hair will start coming back, but they have to go through another hair growth cycle. And so that may be just a stress-related hair loss thing. There are other endocrine or hormonal problems, too, that can trigger hair loss, something called Cushing's disease, which, again, it needs to be diagnosed with some blood work.
Sure.
You know, sometimes we even have to go as far as taking a little skin biopsy and sending it in so that under the microscope, the hair follicles can be evaluated to see what's actually going on. We're heading into winter, and I hope your dog has a nice warm jacket because you're going to need it until you get some answers.
And that's been my big concern because he loves being outside all winter, and he has nothing on his chest.
Yeah. And so I think it's time to either go back to your veterinarian or consider a visit with a veterinary dermatologist to have your dog evaluated.
Good luck.
One final thing is he really hates the vet, and he gets so stressed, and he had to be there for that surgery with him with the plate, and that's what I asked. And he said it wasn't very common where dogs respond to stress like that.
Yeah. It isn't, but we do see it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Matt in Walworth next. Hi, Matt. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
We acquired a 7-month-old puppy, mixed beagle, English bulldog, and he likes to eat his food as fast as he can. And inhale it.
Yeah, that's very, very common for dogs to do that, especially if when they were puppies and being raised with their litter, they just put down like one big bowl and it was a free-for-all. They have to learn to eat really quickly in order to get their fair share of the food. So that's why I always recommend for breeders to have multiple food dishes down for the puppies, so it cuts down on that competition so they're not getting that behavior kind of ingrained, which will then go on when they're in the new home. One thing I would consider, you may want to consider trying, is some of these interactive food bowls that are available for dogs. There's a whole bunch of them out there. If you just Google interactive pet food bowls, you'll get all these pictures coming up. And I know that I've been to many of our local pet stores have multiple types that are out there. Some simple things you can do, though, is just take a big can of like tomatoes or something and put it in the middle of the bowl so it kind of gives an obstacle so your dog has something they have to work around. They make bowls like that have like molded plastic with little pyramids in it as well. There's fancy ones that look like giant blades of grass that you put the food in and the dog has to work around them to try to get the food out. One of my dogs, when I initially brought him home, was a inhaler of his food as well, and I tried to get one of these interactive bowls for him, but being a bulldog, he was so frustrated because he couldn't get his nose down in between, so you have to be careful looking at the way your dog's face is shaped. Are they going to be able to actually get the food out? And so it may be some trial and error until you find the right one, but that would be
luckily he ended up with more of the beagle
okay.
nose than the bulldog.
Yeah, but, and probably the beagle appetite as well.
Yeah,
so,
What about kibble size? Does that make a difference?
It sometimes can. Dogs are really good at swallowing food whole. There are some like dental diets that are bigger chunks that they have to chew, but that would not be something that I would be using for a puppy. That's for dogs that are over a year of age. So right now you're kind of looking at, puppy formulas tend to be kind of smaller pellets, but there are some for like large breed puppies that may be a little bit bigger pellet size that may slow them down a little bit as well. I know the company called Royal Canin makes a bulldog formula, and the kibble looks like almost like a corn chip type thing where it's they're fairly big and have kind of a wave to them, and that it's supposed to slow them down so they don't eat quite as quickly because they're more difficult to swallow. So that might be, again, something that you'd want to look at and feed a breed-specific type food to.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll turn next to Matt in Janesville. Matt, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have an 8-year-old chocolate lab, about 70 pounds, I think she is, and she is a fiend for chocolate. She has eaten in a 2-month period half a bag of Lindorf extra dark cocoa. I think they're the balls or truffles, mm-hmm. whatever they're mm-hmm. called. And then she ate, we went out to Peck's in Spring Green and got probably 2 cups of chocolate-covered coffee beans.
Oh, double whammy there.
Yes, and it was probably a couple weeks in between. We watched really close after that extra dark chocolate, and she just got a little upset stomach. Then recently, I got my wife a couple things of turtles, mm-hmm. and she ate both packs of those. And it's partly our fault. I mean, we have a 6x6 dining room table, and the stuff's been in the center, and one was on the counter. She got to that. That was the Lindorf. But the other two were in the center of the table, and we just didn't think about it.
Yeah. You know, I think this is going to be something that having a dog that's a counter surfer and, you know, be able to get up on tables, you need to have everything behind locked cabinets. I mean, there are some dogs that are so good at getting at human food that we've had to put child locks on cabinets, even if you don't have a child, just to be able to keep the dogs out of there. So I think you need to change your behavior and not leave food around. But, you know, back to how much chocolate is bad for your dog. Boy, I mean, any of those things that you've just mentioned, you are very lucky that your
dog is not dead.
Yeah. Things like the truffles or whatever, the amount of chocolate in there is going to vary depending on what is in the filling. So you have to sometimes guesstimate how much chocolate they're actually eating. But I would strongly recommend if you like chocolate that much and you have it in your house and you have a dog that likes to eat it, download that app that I mentioned, the Chalk Talks app. It's you know, again, you can get it online, you can get it for your smartphone, but it's very, very helpful. That way you can plug in the weight of your dog, what type of chocolate they ate, the approximate amount that they ate, and then it'll tell you need to seek veterinary care, or this is something that probably isn't going to be a problem. The chocolate-covered coffee beans, wow, you know, that's the active ingredient in chocolate is very similar to the caffeine that's in the coffee beans, and that's why I've said it's a double whammy. The dogs can be very, very sensitive to any of those particular chemicals, and so you're lucky that your dog is still with you. So, just be careful, and I'd have to say no amount of chocolate for your dog. Just, you know, cold turkey, none. Okay.
Yeah, and again, that app is called what?
Chalk Talks. Okay, Chocktox.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So there we go. Chalk Talks.
Yeah.
All right. Matt, good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Maybe we can get Rebecca, maybe you can put that up on our Facebook page as well, the site, Chalk Talks. Lihetta Nola sent us a note. This cute 8-month-old Springer, it looks like, mm-hmm. is so cute, and really is cute, but you touch him and his mouth opens to bite. Not vicious biting, but still biting. We've tried toys. Sprays help.
Well, you know, and this is one of these things where if your dog is trying to bite you, we need to find out, is this just play behavior, or is this a dog that is, you know, going to be heading down the road to having more issues with maybe trying to be more controlling or maybe fearful of touch? And getting the help of an applied animal behaviorist, I think, would really be in your dog's best interest, because your dog's young. You've got lots of years ahead of you. And I think using things like redirecting your dog to appropriate toys is obviously the first thing we're going to do. We don't want to play using our hands and encouraging that. I'm not sure what you mean by sprays,
spritz them maybe.
Yeah, maybe, you know, anytime that you're going to be doing something, if the dog knows that, boy, hands are coming to me, I'm going to get sprayed with something, they may be becoming very defensive. So you may be actually backfiring and making your dog worse. So get some help, and hopefully we can have a dog that's going to live out their whole life and be good and not getting into trouble.
Judy in Eau Claire has a question, so let's go to her. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I'm calling about my adorable orange female cat. She's very small. She's about 6 pounds. And she is being treated for Lyme's currently, but in addition to that, she drinks an excessive amount of water. And now for about the last month or more, she won't use the litter box. She is going on a pee pad, which, you know, works okay. But and she has been tested. You know, they did the blood test. It's coming back negative for diabetes. And then I was told there was maybe another type of diabetes she might have that would require.
Yeah, this is, you said this is a cat, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm really concerned about the diagnosis of having Lyme. Cats tend to be very resistant to it. And so I'm wondering, we don't usually even test cats for Lyme disease. So I just wondered where that came from. But I would go back to your vet and just question that as the diagnosis. But I hope that one of the things that they've done besides blood work is also check a urine sample to see, you know, is she passing protein? How is her urine concentrating ability? When I'm thinking of like a cat that is drinking more and urinating more, then I usually get concerned about kidney function. And, you know, just screening for diabetes, doing a blood sugar level is not going to be enough. You need to be looking at these kidney values as well. But that's probably the big thing is kidney disease, diabetes, and then there's another condition that we see in cats called hyperthyroidism that can make them drink more as well. And sometimes they're eating more on top of that. The reason why your cat probably isn't using the litter box is either they have urgency to go because they're making so much urine, and if the litter box isn't kept clean, it's hard to get to. You know, that comforter on your bed's nice and absorbent. Why should I have to go down to the basement to use the litter box down there? So when we have a cat with behavior issues like this, where they maybe have kidney disease or diabetes or something, we want to have multiple litter boxes in the house, preferably one on every floor that's kept clean daily. And then we also worry about cats getting urinary tract infections when they can't concentrate their urine. When we have normal cats, it's really rare to actually see bacterial urinary tract infections because their urine is so concentrated, it just doesn't allow bacteria to grow. But when we have the urine be more dilute because of health reasons, now we've opened up this cat for the possibility of having a urinary tract infection. And even though that urine may look like it doesn't have any indication of infection in it when your veterinarian looks at it, I still recommend culturing it because we see what's called silent urinary tract infections. And it's something that may help your cat if it's just a matter of getting them on the appropriate antibiotic.
There we go.
Okay.
Good luck, Judy. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Paula in Wanakee, thank you for calling.
Hello?
Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I have a 6-month-old golden retriever puppy, and since the day I brought her home, she has peed herself when she's laying down relaxing and sleeping. It's gotten a lot better. It's very rare now. I have this weird theory that she has a gluten intolerance, but that's just kind of baby trial and error.
The only dog that ever has been diagnosed, breed that's been diagnosed with gluten hypersensitivity is the Irish Setter. And so I really think that, you know, this gluten issue, just like it is in people, very few people are actually gluten intolerant. But, you know, and same for dogs. So I would not be thinking that that's the issue. But I'm concerned that as a 6-month-old dog that she is leaking when she's laying down. Is she spayed at this point yet?
Well, that was the question.
You're breaking up. I'm sorry.
You know, sometimes when we have dogs that have been spayed, they can develop some urinary incontinence issues because the estrogen receptors on the bladder sphincter no longer have any of that hormonal production, and that can cause them to have some leaking. It's not every dog that's spayed, but it is something that we can see, and it can be managed medically. There's a couple of different drugs that we use, either an estrogen supplement. There's a couple of different types of that we use, as well as another one called proen or phenylpropanolamine. But if your dog isn't spayed and has been doing this since you've had had her, I worry more about something anatomically. Does she have an ectopic ureter, meaning that one of the tubes from her kidneys to her bladder is not in the proper position, and so they end up just, you know, dribbling urine out? Does she have another type of a bladder abnormality, a bladder sphincter problem? And this may require having some special x-rays and image studies done to be able to make sure that she is, everything's, you know, right on track where it's supposed to be. So unfortunately, with not being able to hear you, I couldn't ask any other questions, but I think this is something that your veterinarian needs to be made aware of ASAP so that she can have some comfort and you don't have as much laundry to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Betty in Madison has a question. Hi, Betty.
Hello. I have a six-year-old tabby who had a urinary tract infection. We got and was 2 pounds overweight. We have that taken care of. And he had been eating IMES food. The doctor said the vet said that he should be taken off from that. And he's now on Royal Canin that he should not be continuing to eat. So I'm wondering what I should feed him.
Well, first of all, I would question that he had a urinary tract infection. I've just mentioned just a second ago that they're actually quite uncommon in cats, especially male cats, to actually have an infection. When we see cats with blood in their urine and straining that are under 10 years of age, urinary tract infections accounts for less than 2% of the cases that we see. So that's really surprising. I'm like concerned that it was an infection. Probably the most common thing that we'll see is what's called sterile cystitis, where it's not due to bacteria, but they get inflammation of their bladder wall. It can result in plugs of tissue and cells that can cause urinary tract obstructions. But these cats will have, be straining to urinate, urinating out small amounts of urine. Usually there's frank blood in it. And for the majority of these cats that have these episodes, they usually last for about a week and then they get better. About the same amount of time that if you had a cat that you put on antibiotics, they would get better as well. And so I question that your cat actually had a urinary tract infection. So if your cat has been diagnosed with this sterile cystitis or bladder stones or anything like that, and that would require your cat to probably have either an abdominal ultrasound or x-rays done to look for the presence of stones, being on probably a lifelong prescription or therapeutic diet that it will be supportive of bladder health. There's like Hills has one that is called CD MultiCare. I know Royal Canin has one out that's for urinary tract health. Nestle Purina has one as well. And I assume that that's what you're talking about with the Royal Canin diet. And because boy cats have the risk of getting a urinary tract obstruction when they're passing all these cells and things like that, I think, and that can be a really life-threatening type situation, it's important for you to keep your cat on one of these therapeutic diets and, you know, going in periodically to have urine samples checked probably wouldn't be a bad idea, too.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck, Betty. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. We have lots of people posting photos and questions on our Facebook page, and we'll get to some of those in just a minute. I'm Larry Mueller with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Really glad to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine to answer your pet health questions. Again, join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo and or question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of the page. Facebook question for Beverly: is over-the-counter canine dewormer effective for tapeworms?
That depends. What you're going to be looking for is you want to get a product that contains an ingredient called praziquantel. And that is available over the counter. And there's various brands out there. It's also in many of the prescription products that you can get from your veterinarian as well. The problem with home medicating and just going and buying something is you need to know what the parasite is. And in the case of tapeworms, dogs can get tapeworms tapeworms a number of different ways. Either there's one that they get from ingesting fleas, and so when we see that particular type of tapeworm called Diplodium, we know that we better be checking for fleas and getting your dog on flea control. There's another one that they can get from, called Tinea, that they get from being scavengers and eating rodents and rabbits and so on, if they're out catching and hunting and eating things. And so that will help us with making sure that we either limit that or start looking for some of the other parasites that those animals can carry, things like roundworms. If you've got a dog that is a kind of chronic scavenger, gets recurrent tapeworms, a very economical way of keeping tapeworms under control is to use one of the monthly heartworm preventatives that has praziquantel in it. And there are a couple of them on the market. There's one that's called Sentinel Spectrum that's a chewable cube that the dog would take, and that gets roundworms, hookworms, whipworms, and tapeworms, as well as controlling, preventing heartworm disease. And then there's another one called Iverheart Max that has praziquantel in it as well. And it's a regular tablet that you're going to have to hide in some food. Praziquantel is one of the most vile tasting things on the face of the earth. So sometimes it can be difficult to get a dog or cat to take this medication. So, but for cats, a neat thing for cats is there's a prescription product out that for tapeworms, it's actually applied topically. And so it gets roundworms and tapeworms, roundworms, hookworms, and tapeworms. And it's called Profender. And it's just a little tube that you put on the back so you don't have to pill them. And boy, has that made our life so much easier.
Oh, I would think, yeah. There you go. Thanks so much for that question. And Pam had a Facebook question. Would you please comment on how to choose from the myriad of brands of dry dog food now available in the pet stores? So many of the brands now say grain-free and now fruits and vegetables as main ingredients and are very expensive. Are they really that much better for dogs as opposed to the more commercial brands that have been around forever?
That depends, okay? First of all, for being a pet food owner, a pet food purchaser, you need to be able to be a label reader. I really have to laugh at some of the pet foods that are out there where very front and center on the package will be things like blueberries and apples. And then when you start looking at the label, remember, everything on the ingredients list is based on weight. And so the things that weigh more are going to be at the top of the list, and things that weigh less are going to be down at the bottom. And when you start looking at these things, you'll find that some of the preservatives and vitamins and things like that that may be added, which are in very small quantities, then they'll be followed up with blueberries or apples or one of these things. And so, you know, they may have a couple of blueberries in the vat of pet food, and yet they're able to put that on the label. So be a label reader so that you know. The grain-free craze started several years ago, and it kind of follows the gluten craze that people have right now too. And you know, are they, those foods actually better for your dog? Not necessarily. Dogs are not strict carnivores. They are omnivores. And as long as grains are cooked and part of the balanced diet, they are providing good sources of fatty acids, carbohydrates, various vitamins, and can be part of that diet. And so one of the things that you want to look at is the diet complete and balanced? And I like to have people feed foods that have actually gone through feeding trials. So you want to see something that says, gone through AFCO feeding trials and supports, you know, dogs of this stage in their life. If it just says formulated to meet AFCO standards, then you know that they've manufactured that food and not necessarily fed it to dogs or cats before it got put on the shelf. So they've just followed a recipe. And we've been seeing some of these foods that don't go through this really thorough testing actually coming back with, you know, recalls, because we've had just recently one of the big premium brands that are out there that does a lot of advertising had to recall some of its cat food because it was too low in thiamine, which is an ingredient that is very sensitive to heat. And when they started processing the canned food, although before they made it, it looked like it had enough in it. After it was manufactured, that thiamine level dropped, and if they had gone through feeding trials with that, they would have picked this up in these cats before it got out on the market. So I still like to stick with the big companies, the ones that can afford to do the testing, rather than the smaller companies, and that's kind of the rules that I go by.
Okay, there we go. Amy in Oconomowoc has a question, so let's go to her. Hi, Amy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a dog that like bites his paws to death, and all the fur is away, and the vet's recommendations haven't really worked that well, so I went to the PetSmart in Delavan, and they suggested a product called Licks Pill Free Skin and Allergy that has like 700 milligrams of fish oil, curcumin, and inositol, and it's like a gravy that I put on my pet's food in a little packet. Is that... If I wanted to go the holistic route, is that something that sounds like it would have enough active ingredients, or is there something you...
Well, that's not probably going to stop the problem. It may help. Okay, fatty acids act as kind of an anti-inflammatory type effect, and so that may help. The most common reasons why dogs chew and lick their feet is because they have some type of underlying allergy, whether it be to things in the environment, house dust mites, pollens, molds, and so on, or to an ingredient in their food, which is much less common than environmental allergens. But we get sniffles and our eyes get runny. Dogs itch. That's the way they respond to things that they are allergic to. And then once they start traumatizing their skin enough, you're going to find that you'll get secondary yeast and bacterial infections that are going to add to the itch. And so that's always the first thing we do, is check for bacterial infections and yeast infections by doing some cytology, collecting some of the material on the bottoms of the feet, between the toes, and treating that effectively. Then we start going down that allergy route. And there's a number of different ways that we can go. There's a drug on the market that is called Apoquil. It's been in short supply for a couple of years, but now is more readily available. Not always, but they're really hiking up their production. But it is like the miracle drug for a lot of dogs that have allergic skin disease. So I don't know what your veterinarian was having you do, but that would be the path that I would take, is treat the secondary infections, stop the itch, and then consider, you know, allergy evaluation, so that we can actually get to the bottom of this, so that we can keep your dog comfortable.
There we go.
Okay, that sounds great. Is Apoquil only from the vet, or could
yes.
I get it at the
No,
store?
No. Okay. It's a prescription product, and you may or may not be able to get it from your veterinarian. We get it in. We have certain sizes that we can get, and then we don't have some sizes, and so it can vary on a month-to-month basis, depending on what the company is able to send out. So check with your veterinarian regarding that. But this is not something that you're probably going to find that over-the-counter products are going to be helpful for. One thing that you can do, though, is make sure that when your dog comes in from outside, that you damp mop them. Wipe their feet to get rid of pollens and so on that they may be picking up that may be causing the allergy. So keep some baby wipes or something like that at the back door, so that when they come back inside, you can give them a wipe down, and sometimes that will help. The fatty acids may help, but boy, you know, I think you really need to be going either back to your veterinarian or to a veterinary dermatologist to get a second opinion.
There you go. Good luck, Amy. Thank you for calling. And we turn to John next in Elk Mound. Hi, John.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a 10-year-old Shar Pei American Eskimo mix. Fantastic dog.
Oh, good.
Kind of emotional for me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Oh.
She's been to the vet. She, about 2 weeks ago, started where... limping really bad, can't hardly walk. We have to carry her up and down the stairs and put her up on the couch. She's not eating well, pretty much refuses food, sleeps all day, and is very non-responsive.
Mm-hmm.
She has a bunch of skin sores all over her back and sides, mostly her back and her sides, top of her head. They're scabbed up. They're like canker sores, kind of. Type sores, and they do have a little oozing coming out of them. Her Lyme's was negative, although well, anyhow, her Lyme's was negative, her heartworm was negative, or they said her kidneys and stuff were okay, although my wife took her in. I don't believe that they actually had a urine test from her.
Okay.
She's on antibiotics. I apologize. I'll get them if you...
That's all right.
Okay. She's on antibiotics, and she's also on a pain pill.
Okay.
We're thinking the pain pill is what's knocking her out completely.
Do you know what that is?
I could do it in just a second. Could I do that?
Yeah. I'm concerned that your dog has something pretty serious going on.
So do I, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that this is, when they're not eating, and most of the pain medication we use have to be given with a meal, and you don't want to give it on an empty stomach.
Well, yeah, we're giving her peanut butter and bread, just to give her something, and yogurt.
Yeah, and I think you need to get an answer as to what these sores are on her skin. To suddenly break with something that serious, I worry about things like skin cancer. There's a condition called cutaneous lymphoma that can really be difficult on a dog and be hard to treat. But you need to be getting some cytology done, maybe biopsies, cultures, so that your dog can be treated appropriately. And I think it's time to go back in again. Your dog sounds like it could be dehydrated and needs some extra care and probably more diagnostics to try to get to the bottom of this. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, or maybe another vet.
Maybe a second opinion. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
I think that would be well worth it.
She's drinking a lot, but seems to be peeing less, if that means anything, too.
Yeah, not necessarily. I mean, if she's not eating, she's not getting a lot, any moisture in her food, so that may be why she's drinking water. But, there's something pretty serious going on with her, and you've got to get to the bottom of why she's limping, too. So rather than just throwing a pain medication at her, getting radiographs, getting something done to be able to determine, maybe she's being a 10-year-old dog, does she have bone cancer or something like that going on. So, good luck.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll be back with Dr. Sandy, right after this look at the news. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for being with us today as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. Thank you for listening in today. Lots of email questions at talk@wpr.org. We have questions on our Facebook page, some great photos. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page for those. And you can also call at 1-800-642-1234. Please give a call. Donna in Elk Mound has a question, so let's go to her. Donna, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, I have a cat. She's 5 years old. I've had her since she was a kitten. Recently, she started vomiting right after eating, and it's been progressively getting worse. We've changed her food. She was eating Meow Mix.
Mm-hmm.
Then we put her on Purina Gentle, the stuffer, because her stomach was upset.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that would help. No, she still got sick off of that. Then we put her on Friskies. It's a canned food.
Yeah, what you're doing is just switching brands, and there's really nothing, not a whole lot different with those foods. What has your veterinarian said about her vomiting?
Well, he didn't seem like he was concerned about it.
Okay.
Because we did take her in. She got shots and so on and so forth.
Yeah, we'll see some cats that are, they just eat really, really fast and inhale their food, and then it comes right back up again after they've swallowed it, and it's just maybe mixed with a little saliva, and there it comes up again. But that's usually not something that we get concerned about. Usually the way we deal with that is slow them down with one of these kind of interactive food bowls, spreading the food out on a cookie sheet or putting it in a muffin tin, something like that, where they have to work to be able to get their food, and it slows them down a little bit. But if your cat is not one of these gulpers that's swallowing their food, or the vomiting is associated with any weight loss, stool changes, change in appetite, then that really needs to be investigated. There's a whole host of things that can cause vomiting, things that are directly related to the stomach, and even things outside of the stomach. Something like feline heartworm disease can present with vomiting, which is kind of odd, but that's one of the symptoms that we'll see is chronic vomiting with that. So I think that if, you know, if your cat falls into that latter category of you know, not eating as much and the stool's a little bit different and losing weight, then it's time to go back to your veterinarian again and say this needs to be investigated because they can't go on like that.
Yeah, that just can't happen.
No.
Good luck, Donna. Thank you for calling. Sarah in Green Bay has a question. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Last February, my husband and I adopted a dog that was a rescue from a shelter down in Alabama. She had a lot of anxiety at the time and was very reluctant and not trusting at all. She seems to really work through that. She's a great dog, great with the kids. However, she licks constantly, and she will lick anything. She will lick our clothes, us, the carpet. She drinks all the time. She's constantly licking her paws and her feet to the point where they're raw. And I'm wondering if there's something that I can do for her, if this is still part of the anxiety.
The licking of her feet, but first of all, I'm going to address the licking of objects other than herself, like licking the carpet and you and clothing and so on. There was a really good study done a couple of years ago looking at excessive licking of surfaces, okay? And they looked at, they had 19 dogs that were in this study to see, you know, what causes this. Is this a behavior issue or is there something else going on? And what they ended up finding is that 14 of those 19 dogs had a medical problem affecting their gastrointestinal tract that they had no other symptoms of. They didn't have diarrhea. They weren't vomiting. They were still eating their food. But because they had some either GI upset for whatever reason, that was, it was expressed by them licking. So that's why when I get these cases in, before I just jump to the conclusion that, oh, this is just a bad habit that your dog has got, I, you know, start looking at, you know, we need to be evaluating your dog to see if there's something, either parasites or refluxing or inflammatory bowel disease or something else, which may mean, you know, starting that, what I call the GI extravaganza. But you start with some of the simple things and then jump to, you know, keep going if you don't find any answers. The licking of the feet, that, just like the previous caller, is one of the big signs that we see with dogs that have allergic skin disease. And then they end up getting secondary bacterial and yeast infections that will promote the licking. So I think you may be dealing with two separate things. That, you know, your dog has something wrong with its skin that's causing them to lick, and then something else that's causing the dog to lick the environment. And I'm not saying that your dog has a gastrointestinal problem. It's just when you're playing the odds, most of the dogs that are doing this excessive licking have something wrong with their gut, and that needs to be addressed and treated.
Okay, so oftentimes when I let her outside to go to the bathroom, she will have a bowel movement, and then, she'll run around and she'll have two or three more bowel movements during the same outing. So yeah. Is that something that would be... Also indicative of that?
Not necessarily. It's often when dogs exercise, they will increases their peristaltic activity in their gut. And so they'll often defecate once, and then there may be some more stool following. So that's not that uncommon for them to go multiple times in one outing, unless the stool is abnormal. If she's having diarrhea, blood, mucus, anything like that, then that would be something that needs to be looked into and be evaluated for either inflammatory bowel disease or parasites or, you know, and so on. And when you do go into your veterinarian, take a stool sample with you. That would be very helpful to have a fresh stool sample brought along so they can do that evaluation.
There you go, Sarah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to get to this email question that we had from Lynette. My cat was just diagnosed yesterday with chronic renal disease, lymphoma, and IBS of both large and small intestines. I was told to give him prednisone twice daily for life for the inflammation of his intestines. I'm confused on the rest, and I want to know what if I what I should do, change food or anything else?
Oh, my goodness. This cat's got really a double whammy here. When we have a cat with kidney disease, one of the things that we will often do is switch the cat over to a kidney-friendly diet. They tend to be a little bit lower in protein. Cats are carnivores, so you can't protein restrict them that much. But because kidneys are involved with the elimination of waste products from protein metabolism, then, you know, we have to feed them higher quality, lower volume of protein. They tend to be higher in potassium, a little bit lower in phosphorus, so they're very specific for meeting the cat's kidney health needs. But for animals with lymphoma, boy, and IBD, and inflammatory bowel disease, it may be allergy related, and sometimes we're feeding these cats a hypoallergenic or a hydrolyzed protein diet may be helpful, but again, that would not be helpful for a cat with kidney disease. And I really think right now, your big thing with your cat is quality of life. It's got some pretty bad diseases going on. The kidney disease, they can live with for a long time, but lymphoma, boy, that's, you know, they can, again, live with it for a long time. I just lost one of my patients that was diagnosed with gastrointestinal tract lymphoma, how long ago? It was 6 years ago, and she just passed away, and so she was being able to be managed quite well. But it really depends on the type of lymphoma, and that's where getting intestinal tract biopsies would be helpful so that you kind of have a better idea of what the prognosis is going to be for your cat, whether it's large cell or small cell or T cell, B cell. I'm not an oncologist, so they're probably all the oncologists out there are laughing at me right now as I'm rattling these things off. But boy, I would just give your cat anything it wants to eat right now.
Ruth in Mineral Point, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a 12-year-old male cat who on October 15th showed up with, he's an indoor-outdoor great hunter, usually has at least a mouse a day, and he showed up with his third eyelid swollen, about, you know, maybe a quarter of his eyelid, that third eyelid swollen.
Mm-hmm.
Took him to the vet because that's always an indication that something's wrong. And he couldn't figure out what it was. He thought perhaps that he'd gotten into some mice that had been poisoned or something. He'd also lost 2 pounds and was dehydrated. And I had noticed that his basic character and actions, daily actions, had changed a bit. So we gave him some antibiotics and dewormed him. He'd been dewormed regularly, so I didn't think that was a problem, but... And he took, so we went, okay, so 2 days later, that eyelid had swollen to almost cover his eye.
Oh, my goodness.
I went back to the vet. He did urine, blood, hydrated him, and, every test came back normal.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, a couple things that I'm concerned about. The fact that it's just one eye. Sometimes when cats are dehydrated or have lost a significant amount of weight, their eyeballs will kind of sink back in the socket. And the third eyelid doesn't have any of its own ability to move. It comes up in relation to where the eyeball is. So if the cat has pulled its eyeball back, that third eyelid's going to come up and kind of cover the eye. The fact that it's just one eye, and you say it's swollen, not just like covering the eye, but actually swollen, I worry about things like, you know, is there something going on like a third eyelid tumor? Is there something actually wrong with the eyeball itself? Did they evert that third eyelid and look on the underside of it to see if there was anything abnormal in that area, like foreign material or anything like that stuck?
Yes, I went to another vet. And they did all those tests, and it's in both eyes. It's not just one eye.
Okay.
And it became puffier and thicker, and it is thinned out some. We continued the antibiotics. He's been on prednisolone.
Okay, which is a steroid. Uh-huh.
And it changes color very slightly, sometimes a little pinkish, sometimes a little mauve colored. They did tests. They put drops in to try to shrink it, you know, to see if it would respond.
Mm-hmm.
Did for pressure, nothing.
Okay.
And it's now It's now, what, November 13th, and we're about done with the prednisone. And he, although he seems better, he's gained some weight, and I see him drinking more. We also had a stool test.
I think this is a case where it sounds like your cat has had appropriate workup, and they've tried, you know, doing things therapeutically as well. And I would be recommending, if you were my patient and I was like, oh, let's try this, try that, you know, we try to rule out these other things. And if I can't find an answer, I'm very lucky. I have a whole fleet of ophthalmologists right around the corner from where primary care is. I would be recommending that you ask your veterinarian to refer you to one of our state's ophthalmologists. There are several board-certified ophthalmologists in the state of Wisconsin. We have, like I said, a fleet of them at the vet school, but there are other places in Milwaukee, Green Bay, and so on, where you're going to be able to get referred. So hopefully it's not going to be too much of a drive for you. But I really think that that is in orders. And when you do go to see a specialist, it's really helpful to bring all of your medical records with you so that they can see what's been done and kind of the response to therapy, lab results, those types of things, so that maybe tests don't have to be repeated. But I think that is where you're at right now, is going to a specialist. They may be looking at getting a biopsy of that third eyelid to see what's going on. But the fact that it's bilateral rather than just one eye, you know, I'm just wondering if there's something metabolically going on with the cat that is causing this. Since if the eyeballs are sinking back, you've got both those third eyelids coming up. But I really don't know what to tell you, and I'd be referring my patients to our ophthalmology department for something like this.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you, Ruth, for calling. Appreciate it. And Jay and Two Rivers, thank you for calling. Hello. Oh, sorry, Jay, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Our last dog was a 110-pound yellow lab mix, and he lived a good long life. And our present dog, an Aussie border collie mix, half that weight, shares a problem that he had, and we found that we have to use feed them high-protein dog food, or their stool is excessively moist and difficult to pick up. Now, I understand that too much protein can be hard on the kidneys, and I'm wondering if there's are there other ingredients I should look for in the dog food label? We've tried different brands. They both were thoroughly checked out with numerous GI tests.
Yeah, every dog is going to be different as to what kind of fat level, fiber level, that type of thing that they can tolerate. And I, you know, right now, even though I kind of, like for my own pets, I kind of said, you know, grain-free isn't something that's necessary. I found a diet that both my dogs can eat, and they both have normal stool, and it makes my life so much better than having to like wipe bottoms when they come in and that kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of times it's kind of hit or miss. You try to find a food that's going to be appropriate for your dog. And, you know, being a label reader, looking at the guaranteed analysis so that you can say, okay, this is the food that they're getting right now. This is the fat level. And then if you're going to be switching diets, try to find one that's very similar to that. But anytime you introduce a new food, you want to do it slowly over several days of gradually introducing the new food to the old food, so you don't cause that sudden change in their gut, and that can actually cause some problems for the dog with them having some GI upset. So, you know, you're right about the high protein. You know, once you've reached the level of protein that the dog actually needs, then that protein just gets broken down for energy, and as long as their kidneys are functioning fine, they shouldn't have any trouble. It's not like you're going to be causing kidney disease. And in fact, a low protein diet doesn't prevent them from getting kidney disease either. It's used for managing kidney disease, but it's not a preventative as well. So if you've hit the right food, I'd say stay with it. But if you want to change, try to stay with that same guaranteed analysis and kind of save your labels and take them to the pet store and do some label reading.
Thank you much.
Yep, thanks much for calling, Jay. Paula in Fort Atkinson. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a kitty who's 11 years old, who's always been very friendly and outgoing. She loves strangers. She's a lap cat. But in the last 4 months, she's lost 3.5 pounds, which is quite a bit.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That's...
I took her to the vet. She does have a bad UTI. There was quite a lot of blood in her urine. He put her on pain meds. She's starting an antibiotic today. Let's see, what is it? Amoxicillin. I have to give it to her twice a day.
Okay.
She's also... She's taking so much now. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know, anytime we have that kind of excessive weight loss, and this is something that it doesn't even have to be that excessive, but anytime we see a change in a cat's weight when there hasn't been any change in diet or exercise level, it gets us concerned, especially in senior cats, because there's the whole host of things that can be causing some problems, things like overactive thyroid glands, cancers, kidney disease, diabetes, and the fact that your cat has a urinary tract infection makes me think that, you know, does she have kidney disease? Is she diabetic? So I hope that your veterinarian's also done some blood work besides looking at the urine to be able to look into these things, because that's a significant amount of weight loss for a cat. Like when you look at, you know, your average cat should be like 8 to 10 pounds, and your cat's lost 3 pounds of its body weight. Boy, that's, you know, something to be concerned about. And then very carefully monitoring that weight to make sure that they're not losing any more. But hopefully your vet can get to the bottom of this and your cat can go on to live to a ripe old age.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Paula. And Pam, thank you for calling from Gladstone, Michigan. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry and Doctor. I called you guys probably December of last year about my pug that I lost due to, we believe it was pug dog encephalitis. I lost my second dog in January. He had congestive heart failure. He was my little 13-year-old Shih Tzu. And then I lost my last two dogs in August.
Oh, my goodness.
Both to cancer. So I lost all my dogs in 9 months. But I'm very fortunate that we have adopted an adorable little 2-year-old dog from our local animal shelter. And since losing my dogs to cancer, I've read about aflatoxins that can be in carbohydrates in pet food, mainly grains, but I know they can also be in legumes. And after losing my two to cancer, I just want to, you know, I'm just thinking about what to feed my little guy that I have now. And my dogs were eating grain-free for years, and they still got cancer. And of course, I don't know if it's related to
that. Yeah, you know, I really wish I could tell owners what the cause of their dog's cancer is. We know that for some dogs, it runs in the breed. There's certain types of dogs that we see different types of cancer in more commonly. It's one of those things that, I mean, this sounds kind of a little crass, but, you know, if your dog doesn't get hit by a car early in its life and lives to be an older dog, they're going to usually die of either cancer, heart disease, kidney disease. You know, those are kind of the top things that we see. And if there was some magic food or ingredient that we could give or feed or even take ourselves that would prevent cancer, I think we would be having that readily available to all of us by now. So, you know, I think always feed the food that your dog, that agrees with your dog, that your dog does well with, that you can afford, that your dog likes. But I don't think that there's one specific diet or ingredient out there that's going to be at risk for causing that.
And Pam, thank you so much for calling. We are about out of time. I just want to mention and thank Dean Perrin, who sent a photo of his St. Bernard. And he posted a month ago, and since then, the St. Bernard is 40 pounds heavier.
Oh, my goodness, and what a cutie. You know, I hope we get a picture next month, too. So
yeah, Dean sent us one next month as well. And Sandy, thank you so much.
You are welcome. We'll see you next month.
She'll be back in a month, second Tuesday of the month, so look forward to that. And look forward to tomorrow. We'll talk about preparing wild game, some new recipes, and then to honor our veterans, William Doyle will be talking about his new book, PT-109, and it is a fascinating read, I can tell you that. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.